All right, thanks for Bob and Emery to have me here. And it's been such a great time here, and I hope we can continue this. So what I'm going to talk about is the two straddle both systems, the vomeronasal nasal system and the main olfactory system. So the question that, I'm asking is that for these two subsystems of the mammalian olfactory system, what do they do? And is there a specific coding strategy that they use to encode the sensory input and generate specific output? So here, I just want to emphasize that the two subsystems not only have different receptors, but also have different pathways in the brain. The main olfactory system goes to the cortical areas and before reaching into some of the action centers. The vomeronasal organ, on the other hand, through the accessory olfactory bulb, projection bypasses all the cortical areas directly into the amygdala and some of the hypothalamic nuclei to elicit innate behaviors. So to answer the question, we started by looking at the population responses both in the vomeronasal organ and also in the olfactory bulb. So here is when I started my lab about 10 years ago, the first thing we did is to generate perhaps the first GCAMP animal that used in neuroscience, GCAMP2 at the time. And using a tetraoral system, we can drive the GCAMP2 expression in both the vomeronasal organ and the main olfactory epithelium. And if you cut the slice, as you can, Tim already showed, that we can see very high level expression of GCAMP2. And this allows us to perform slice imaging of VNO response to different stimuli. So here, superimposed three different stimuli, male, female, and predator urine. You can see many of the cells are activated by the three stimuli, and some of the cells are overlapped, some are not. And we have been focusing on the sexual cues, recognition of sexual cues by the vomeronasal organ. So here is a profile of the response from a single VNO slice. What you have here is 134 cells, and these 134 cells are stimulated with 10 different stimuli. Those are urine samples from 10 individuals, male and female, and from three different strains and individual differences within the strains. So what you can see here is that individual urine sample elicit a very specific set of cell response. Some of these are active. Some of these cells are activated by every single thing that you use to stimulate. So these do not carry much information, and there are some others that are highly diverse and attuned to individuals. So by analyzing this kind of pattern, you can clearly see that the sort of correlation analysis, that the male and female samples are clearly separated. And within the male or female samples, these patterns can be grouped according to strain information. And then within the strain, you can see the difference between the individuals. And another thing that came out of this is that we see two specific populations of neurons. One group respond very specifically to male pheromones, because they respond only to the male urine samples, but none of the female urine samples. A second group, what we call the female urine-specific cells, respond to only the female samples, but not males. In addition to this simple sex difference, we also see in the female urine sample, the estrous urine can activate more cells. And you do a profiling of these, you can see that some of the cells are only responding to the mouse urine, female urine from collected from estrous females, but not from the males, from the diestrous phase. And there are other cells that are totally independent of the estrous status of the animal. So what we want to do is to try to identify the neurons and the receptors that carry this specific information. And the strategy, so the vomeronasal organ express about 400 different receptors that belongs to three classes of large family of G-protein coupled receptors. So the strategy we adopted was to it was the following. So we will take a BNO slice and stimulate with urine samples from multiple individuals. And now we do the profiling online, and then to identify individual cells that show the specific response pattern. For example, we would identify a male urine-specific cell, and then using a patch pipette to suck out the contents of the cell. And then we can use degenerate RT-PCR to identify the receptor. Now we have been going into single-cell RNA-seq, trying not only to identify the receptor, but also the other co-regulated genes. So this has been published, so I'm going to go quickly. So what we found is that the cells we have identified responding to female pheromone cues are mostly B1R family of receptors. In particular, what we found is that the cells that are responded to this so-called female sex cue, in the cells we identified, all express genes belong to this E clade of V1R. And what's interesting is that all the five genes we identified are located on chromosome 7, none of them on chromosome 17, despite the similarity of their sequences. And for the estrus cue, and which we actually used the sulfate estrogen that Tim identified as a strong ligand, the cells that we identified that all express genes belong to this J clade of receptors. We identify one J1, J2, and J3 receptors. So in order to verify this sort of a response profile, and as well as to using these receptors to identify the ligand that activates them, we have adopted a transgenic approach in which we use a TET system not only to express in the same cell GCAMP2, but also the cloned receptor, and those receptors are marked by T-tomato. So in the same cell that it's driven by the either G-gamma-8 or OMP promoter, we can have the receptor with GCAMP2 and also the marker protein, T-tomato. So most of the cells here express both markers and the cloned receptor. And using this receptor, we can characterize the response. So here is an example using the V1R E9 and E12 receptor that we made into transgene. And you can see here that the neurons ectopically express E9 or E12 receptor respond robustly to the female urine sample, regardless of which strain it comes from, but not much beyond the basal level to the male urine samples. And the response to female urine samples are independent of estrus cycle. So the day one and day two are usually the estrus period, and we don't see any difference between the estrus or diestrus female urine samples. So now, with these transgenes, we can now using to add a screening method. So we can run HPLC and collect different fractions of HPLC run, and to identify which fraction contains the active component to activate, say, E9 receptor or E12 receptor or the J2 and J3. So what we have found is that in these two adjacent fractions, the T16, what we call, contain this female cue that activate the E9 and E12 receptors. And this next fraction, the T17 fraction, contains the estrus cues. And we can also use this strategy to use known chemical ligand and to study their ligand specificity. So here is a collection of data what we have used using the sulfated steroids and glucuronidated steroids to add a ligand to activate the J receptors. So what you can see here is that I want to direct your attention to this group of compounds. Those are two sulfated estrogen compounds, and they can activate the J2 and J3 at nanomolar and subnanomolar concentration. Other steroids, either sulfated or glucuronidated steroids, can also activate them, but their affinity for the receptors are much lower. So these are highly specific receptors and extremely sensitive. And there are another high, with structures similar compounds do not activate those two receptors at all. And so by looking at across different compounds, we noticed that this sort of estrogen backbone is important. It tolerates some variation of, say, you can have a meso group or have a single double bond here, tolerates some of the structural variations in this structure. But the group, this three primed carbonyl group is very important for this configuration. So the beta configuration is essential. So we have a set of vomeronasal nasal receptors, a highly specific and highly sensitive. And what do they do in triggering innate behavior? So here what we have is a behavior paradigm, which I will focus on the mating part of it. So when the mouse are encountering each other, they sniff each other and investigate the facial and the urogenital areas. Once they recognize the potential, the intruder, either as intruder or as a potential mate, and they, as recognition of the potential mate will initiate in the males a set of mating ritual, including pursuit and mounting, eventually allowing the male to successfully mount the male, the female. In the end, they can reach satiety. So what we have done is using the ovorectomized female, so to remove any hormonal fluctuation of the females, and introduce the female into the mouse, in the male mouse home cage. And then we can paint either with nothing, or with sulfate estrogen, or with the T16 fraction or T17 fraction. So from this experiment, what we found is that introducing these individual compounds or fractions alone do not elicit mating behavior measured as the duration or frequency of mounting beyond more than the vehicle controls. However, when we add the two compounds together, either by putting T16 and sulfate estrogen together, or by recombining the T16 and T17 together, we significantly augmented the mating behavior. So that suggests that there's a coordinated action of the pheromones that can trigger a very specific mating behavior. So this suggests that there's a circuit that controls this. And one way we're thinking about, there are many different models we can think about, but two big categories are what we call parallel integration versus a hierarchical integration. For example, here we need both sulfate estrogen or the estrus cues plus the female cues together. It's probably form the end logic gate to trigger arousal and mounting behaviors. And as I showed you, that we have identified multiple receptors for the female cue and multiple receptors for the estrus cue. So potentially, you have a different way of controlling this. For example, you can have a redundancy in the receptors that recognize the same set of a cue, and this form an OR gate, and the two sets together to form an AND gate that elicit mounting. Alternatively, you can have this hierarchical integration. For example, estrus signal could trigger arousal, but only in the presence of a female cue, then the mating can proceed. And you can switch around this too. And one of the advantage is perhaps that you can, separate these two signals and using either male or female cues as a gate to control whether you actually start mount the intruders or not. So I won't go into details, but we have now some preliminary data that suggests this pathway might be the one that are in action in the vomeronasal nasal system. So what we have done is using the CRISPR technology, CRISPR-Cas9 technology, to knock out individual J receptors. And from these mice, we found there's no difference in the mating behavior. It's still preliminary, but the indication is that we don't see any obvious defect in the mounting behavior. What's striking is that knocking out a single receptor, V1R E9 receptor, that resulted the normal investigation and the attempt to mount. But those males inevitably failed to mount, to successfully mount the females. So as if that the V1RJ pathway activated by the female cues is somehow control a very specific downstream circuit that leading to successful mounting. So we are pursuing this and trying to figure out the circuits that really control this process. So here, I just want to give you a summary about the vermal nasal part of the talk. What we think is that there are highly specific receptors that are directly linked to very specific behaviors, and that this information is likely processed by an innate circuit that has an intrinsic logic gate to control the behaviors. I'll acknowledge this people who have done the work, and I'll take questions.
Questions?
So I think that the general idea that, you know, odorant receptors respond to multiple compounds is obviously true, but then we've got sort of a distribution where some are much more broadly tuned than others. So is there anything that this would sort of add to that model? Is there any advantage in this framework to having that sort of
So I think it probably adds robustness. So if you so we have played with different ways of decoding it using machine learning, supporting vector machine. And you can train the set to achieve, you know, relatively good level. But as soon as you start add noise or trying to change the encoders by removing a receptor, or you know, and then the thing collapse and become pretty bad. So here, what I'm showing here is that you can rely on very small set of receptors and still can decode it quite accurately. And the noise resistance, I think it's very robust. And I think, you know, when you are looking at the glomerular response, 5 to 10% variability is quite common. But when we perceive odors, you can be far away and, you know, you can do a simple sniff, you can, you know, tell what's there. So I think that's added the robustness.
So in which space do you think things are sparse?
In
which space do you think things are sparse? Because if you try to do compressed sensing and you assume that things are,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
that the intensities of pixels are sparse, you'll get the wrong answer.
Right. So you can transform that into different domains, and then, so we don't know how the transformation, what the transformation is. And in this case, what we are, you know, the odor space, out of the millions and billions of chemicals, there's only, you know, so many that, so in terms of in that odor space, that's already sparse. And then the chemical features, whether they can activate the receptors, that's probably also quite a selective set, which I think also sparse. But that we don't know until we have a full, which will be a difficult task to figure out what all the features are. But here what we're seeing is that, you know, once the information from the glomerulus is being unpacked into, say, the microcells or the piriform responses, and that becomes sparse again. So we have a sparse features space too. So if you look at the one that we construct to represent the odor using the constructed features, and those are quite sparse, you know, get it anywhere. And I'm sure, you know, if we incorporate the temporal dynamics, it can add a lot more information, probably power for discrimination.
Other questions? Lisa alluded earlier to the complexities of interpreting the TRPC2 knockout, but given your result on the knockout of the V1RE9, if I remember correctly,
right.
You said. How do you interpret the reproductive challenges that animal faces versus the relative, interesting impairments, but not execution impairments of the TRPC2 knockout animal?
Yeah, so if these animals, if you leave them with the male, with the female for a long time, eventually they will mate. But in the behavior assays, we see in 30-minute period, they fail to mount a successful mounting of the female. The controls can do it. And you can see, I don't have the time to show the videos, what you see is that they pursue, they attempt, but they fail to establish the pelvic contact and the intromission, basically. And that's very specific. You look at the individual one, they said, okay, this is the E9 knockout. Yeah. So, it's quite striking. We did not anticipate this to happen.
I'm still trying to figure out the model assumptions that you made here regarding, in the beginning I thought you want to infer the concentration vector of the odors from this 1,000 receptors, but then you're using a different dictionary than the ones with which the concentrations are encoded in the receptor
responses. Here we don't have concentration information. So there's two different experiments. Are you talking about this one?
No.
There's no.
Basically, I was talking about your Z vector, I think. So the.
Oh, you mean the
one where you do the sparse recovery and the compress.
Yeah, so compressed sensing is often used in the context of can you essentially reconstruct the stimulus, even, for instance, in cases of mixture, I guess is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So where essentially each entry of the vector that you're trying to reconstruct is, in that case, maybe a yes-no, whether any given individual component was present, and you might allow there to be three or four different mixture components at once.
Right. So mixture part, we have no idea at this moment. And I think there's two possibilities. One, you can actually totally segregate those, but others, you could have a new way of identify the mixtures as a novel thing. So we don't know anything about that at this moment. We haven't tested any of these yet.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, let's thank the speaker again. Our next speaker is Vikas Bandawat, who has done some really beautiful things that I teach on in terms of olfactory sensory transduction, and who has launched into the world of flies in the last several years. And the title of his talk, is Independently Controlled Behavioral Primitives Underlie Behavioral Response to Odors.